Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I have the real pleasure in person to talk to the author of Democracy Against Domination, published in 2016 by Oxford University Press. The author is Sabil Rahman. Sabil, how are you?
Hi, Heath. Great to be here.
Sabil, it's such a pleasure to have you in person to talk about the book. I've talked to you before about the book, but now we're going to talk about it for the podcast. Before we get to it, let's hear just a little bit more about yourself. Who are you?
Great. Well, it's glad to be here and talk with you about all of this. And hello to the listeners. So I teach administrative and constitutional law at Brooklyn Law School. I'm also a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and New America, and generally work on issues of economic policy and democratic theory.
The book is in many ways as broad as you just described some of your background, and you have even minimized the breadth of your previous experiences and what you think about. It's a book about law and about politics and about government. You take on a lot in the book, though this is the rare book with no subtitle, which I'm not going to ask you about because It's just something that I think alone is worth pondering. So let's put that to the side for a second, unless you feel like There's a really interesting story behind that. Let's start with some terminology that's important to kind of get on the table before we talk about the meat of the book. So in the book, you refer to managerialism, particularly in the early parts of the book. I wonder if you would place that term into context, both historical, but also how it relates to the purpose of the book. So tell us about managerialism.
Absolutely. And I think as you alluded, the book is really trying to look at both how our ideas about the role of government and the relationship between democracy and economy has changed over time. So looking at sort of the intellectual history of that and the very real sort of implications that those ideas have for how we design public policy, how our institutions operate. And so I'm kind of really looking at that intersection of ideas and institutions. And so for me, managerialism is a key concept in the book because I think it captures a lot of sort of one particular mode of thinking about the economic role of the state. So the best way to think about it, I think, is as a line that connects sort of what we think of as the classic New Deal state of FDR through to what we saw in the last few years with the Obama administration trying to respond to the financial crisis. And in the book, I kind of frame this particular approach to government as managerialism in a couple of senses. So I think the idea of managerialism in part is about a particular view of the purposes of economic policy, that on this view, the role of government is to manage, to optimize the functioning of the market, you know, closing market failures, managing excessive risk, and so on. And so this, you can kind of, you see this, for example, in a lot of how the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Bill from 2010 deals with the problem of too big to fail finance, you know, essentially, addresses that by giving a lot more resources and authority and power to technocratic regulators, right, at the Fed, at the SEC. And that's a perfectly reasonable way of thinking about this, right, and harkens back to, in some ways, the New Deal. But by focusing in on that in the book, I try to raise some questions about, A, historically, that's not the only way that in American politics we've thought about the role of the state, And B, that there are some sort of normative and sort of policy implications that might be problematic if you sort of play that out.
Yeah, let's talk about just that. This managerial approach to governance, as you note, emphasizes expertise, but is also prone to certain kinds of problems. I wonder if you could talk about in which ways we might worry about corruption and regulatory capture in such a system. Why are those two of the real sort of the areas of concern that we might have?
Yeah, so I think we're used to thinking about our political discourse as a clash between sort of free market, laissez-faire, kind of libertarian view, which is kind of hostile to government regulation, right? Presumes a kind of automatic self-correcting nature to economic markets, and these defense of government regulation, government oversight in various forms. But as you mentioned in your question, the idea of managerialism really depends on a deep faith in expertise and in regulatory institutions to serve the public good. Now, I in many ways, I'm sympathetic to that view. But what I think we can tend to overlook when we're sort of trying to give it the argument for why government regulation is needed is that there are very real concerns about how do we ensure governmental institutions, regulatory institutions, are resistant to regulatory capture, to undue influence on the part of regulated industries, right, or other interest groups, and how do we ensure that it's the idea of economic regulation by experts can be reconciled with our sort of normative values of democratic accountability, democratic responsiveness, democratic legitimacy. Now, I think oftentimes in our sort of political discourse, you'll hear those concerns raised on the right, usually as a vehicle for trying to get rid of, dismantle the regulatory state entirely. That's not necessarily the direction I want to go. In the book, part of the drive of the book is to try to say that, look, there are some real concerns here, but our response shouldn't be to dismantle the regulatory state because we need it to respond to all sorts of problems in an unchecked market economy. The answer should be to think more deeply about how we can democratize the regulatory state, to bind it more closely to some of our ideas about democratic participation and responsiveness. And so as the book kind of moves from critique to construction, I try to engage then with other literatures and ideas, for example, in administrative law, about how we could rejigger the administrative process to make it more democratic, to make it more resistant to worries about capture or failure.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about that theoretical scholarship that you turn to. There's a couple of scholars, legal and political, that you focus on. I wonder if you can, briefly talk about each and how they, what they do to build this argument, this sort of counter narrative that you're building about the solution to regulatory capture.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think about this sort of in, at three levels and, I'm kind of synthesizing a bunch of different literature. So the think about it historically, theoretically, and then practically. Right. So, historically, part of the, one of the things that's really fascinating to me is when you go back to the intellectual origins of the regulatory state, we're all familiar with the New Deal, but in some ways, the more interesting period historically is before the New Deal in the populist and progressive era, sort of late 19th, early 20th century. And this is where American politics is sort of trying to wrestle with the upheavals of industrialization, and that's provoking a bunch of different reform ideas and sort of political theorizing about the role of government and governmental institutions. And when you look at the thought of this period, I think you see a much more variated set of ideas about how we would design these institutions. So definitely there is the sort of strain that emphasizes expertise and the emergence of social science as a way to manage a complex modern economy. But you also see the emergence of a sort of morally rich discourse about the problem of power and the idea of democracy. And so if you think about people like, say, Louis Brandeis, right, for Brandeis was in part a proponent of scientific management, but he also saw the central problem of economic policy as a moral challenge to counteract concentrations of private power, say, in monopolies or, kind of J.P. Morgan as a financial giant, right? So he's worried about private power, and he sees in the idea of democracy a way to check private power through governmental institutions. And so In a lot of his writings and in a lot of his legal advocacy, you see an attempt to try to synthesize the idea of democratic mobilization on the one hand and expertise that can help sort of effectuate the democratic public's policy desires on the other. And you see this similar kind of marriage of democracy and expertise in the work of people like John Dewey. So historically, I think there's a really interesting kind of attempt to reorient the relationship between regulatory expertise and ideals of democracy. That, I think, links up to a bunch of similar currents in contemporary democratic theory, which I talk about in the book. And you put all of that together, and then I think that points to a bunch of practical ideas or debates that are happening in areas like regulatory reform. So I talk about a couple of different avenues that this could take, for example, incorporating more forms of stakeholder representation and proxy advocacy within the regulatory state, experimenting with modes of participatory governance through the regulatory process. These are all things that sort of would be well within bounds of current administrative law, but not necessarily sort of prioritized areas of policy innovation.
Now, even before we get to that, why not? Because one of the possible directions you might have taken is to shift some of this back to elected officials, shift it back to the legislative branch in some capacity. Your solution is not that type of democracy. Why not? What's the disadvantage of moving, let's say, the Dodd-Frank approach into congressional committees, for
right.
example?
So
why not that democratic institution?
Yeah, that's a great question and something that I struggle with in thinking about these issues. You know, I mean, on the one hand, it's certainly true that you can't have an effective democracy when the seat of democratic sovereignty, the legislature itself, is corroded by, you know, interest group influence, corruption, sclerosis, right, what have you. So certainly I think that's an important project of figuring out how we can make our legislative institutions more democratically responsive. But I think as a student of the regulatory state, I'm just skeptical that we can fully sort of reabsorb the decision-making apparatus of the modern administrative state back into the legislature. I think it's simply not realistic or feasible even to think about a policymaking process that is purely legislative without an administrative component. I think even with a well-functioning legislature, you necessarily would still have to have this sort of stages of policymaking where the legislature sets the broad terms of what the agencies then sort of refine and implement and execute, right? That's the nature of the delegation, you know, from the legislature to the administrative state. That, I think, is endemic to modern governance. So even with a well-functioning legislature, we still have to grapple with this question of how should agencies go about making the mix of normative, moral, and technical judgments that go into, say, implementing, a financial reform? Even if Dodd-Frank had in the statute required, say, a 15-to-1 leverage cap or a strong Volcker rule against proprietary trading, or even breaking up the banks, you know, all of which were proposed in Congress, right, in 2010, even on those terms, you still need the agencies to implement and design those policies. So there's still political decision-making happening downstream from the legislature, which means that there's still this question about the relative democraticness or responsiveness of those decisions.
So, and if we accept sort of this abstract normative argument, what does this mean in practice? What really do you have in mind that would alter this and enhance democracy? What the specific kind of democratic institutions that you would see as compatible with financial regulation, but also with the aspirations to be more democratic?
Yeah, absolutely. And so to get to that question, we step back just for a second. I think the idea of democracy that I'm working with in the book is both substantive and procedural, right? So in some of the title of the book is the idea in a nutshell, right? I think sort of the central problem in the modern economy in general, right, is a moral problem of domination, of economic power, right? What we really, it's not just about market failures or market efficiency. What we really ought to be worried about is the degree to which our economic system, which is a product of law and policy, concentrates power, distributes economic opportunity in different ways, right? And so something like the too big to fail problem is a great distillation of that sort of moral challenge. At the same time, we have these sort of procedural questions, for, if we can call it that, right, about who's involved in the governmental decision-making and so on. So I think the idea of democracy that I'm working with is both substantive, as in oriented against the problem of domination, and procedural, as in committed to a more inclusive participatory mode of making decision-making. So then if we think about sort of what this means in practice, I think the implications sort of also arise in these two domains, right? So substantively, I think, you know, we've seen even through the last most recent election, the sort of persistent concern about concentrated economic power, whether it's Wall Street or other sort of modes of private power, sort of indicates that, you know, there's a very real sense in which our democracy is not real unless we are able to impose more structural restraints on concentration of private power. So one of the applications in the book I talk about are sort of what would be more structural limits that we could have imagined, say, on too big to fail financial firms as a component of assuring a broader sort of democratic system. That's on the substantive side. On the procedural side, I think there are a bunch of ways that we could instantiate some of these ideas of including greater representation and participation in the administrative process. I'll mention just two very quickly. You know, I think there's some really interesting ideas that come out of how, for example, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau operates. This is also a creation of the 2010 reforms. And, you know, it's a regulatory agency like many others, but in a lot of its day-to-day operations, it actually invests pretty heavily in different forms of stakeholder engagement, you know, civic participation as a way of setting agendas and identifying sort of the problems that the agency then can focus on. So there's a lot of interesting sort of practices that come out of examples like that. And then I give a bunch of examples more from the War on Poverty era, where you had a more concerted effort by agencies and also by Congress to experiment with different modes of grassroots bottom-up participation in setting economic policy and regulation in a bunch of different fronts. Now that, I think, also connects up with a bunch of other innovations, experiments in participatory governance today. But these are the kinds of things that I'm interested in exploring more.
This all is so compelling in so many ways. But we have a new administration taking control of government nearly as we speak. I wonder if you could reflect a little bit and assess either some of the key appointments that have been made or the direction that the regulatory state might take, and how compatible it is with this vision. Do you see the potential for the new administration not taking your book necessarily seriously, but taking some of the underlying thoughts, given that we had a campaign where many of these same concerns were expressed by both Republicans and also Democrats? And so are we likely to see the direction that you suggest, or the other that you mentioned earlier, which is the opposition to the regulatory state in the form of more laissez-faire and more market control? And so what do you see?
Yeah, right. It's a great question. I think you know, those of us who do political science and public policy for a living are sort of all trying to figure out, right, what's coming down the pike as the administration turns over. So this last this campaign in this new administration, I think, sort of really sharpen or cast into sharper relief a lot of these contrasts that I'm talking about in the book. So you know, on the one hand, I think there's a good case to be made that you know, the campaign we just saw on both sides really pitted this sort of managerial technocratic view of government, you know, with all of its virtues and limitations, against populist challenges from both left and right. And in some ways, the thing that united, or I shouldn't say united, the one of the common threads between sort of the populism of the right and populism of the left that we saw over the campaign was this deep anxiety with economic power. And the sort of sense that our government and our democracy is sort of gotten away from us, right? It's sort of being overrun by various forms of economic power and economic instability that seem to sort of be beyond the scope of what our current sort of officials are able to deal with right now. That's a sentiment. It's not, you know, necessarily sort of wholly accurate, but I think that clash sort of speaks to some of the limitations of the managerialism that I criticize in the book, and sort of shows the need for recovering a more thick, robust, morally rich idea of democracy as anti-domination. So that's the first point I would make. The second point I would make is that, you know, I think as we're seeing the Trump administration come into office, and, you know, obviously lots of things can change, but it looks to me like we're sort of seeing a convergence of two strains on the right, both of which I think are quite hostile to some of the normative ideas that I talk about in the book. The first is a sort of repackaged version of kind of familiar deregulatory, you know, laissez-faire libertarian type policy agenda. And I think we're likely to see a big push both from Congress and from the new administration to dismantle a lot of the regulations, say, on finance or on competition policy or what have you. And so that would very much sort of be a problem on the sort of democracy as anti-domination view. But I think we're seeing that combined with a sort of kind of an exclusionary version of populism, to the extent that that's still sort of part of the new administration sort of rhetoric. So in some ways, you know, it sounds populist in that it's, you know, anti-Wall Street, anti-government corruption, and so on. But it's an exclusionary version of populism in that, you know, the subtext, or in many ways the explicit text of kind of Trumpian populism, is a particularly narrow notion of who the people are. Who are the people that that this version of populism is trying to protect? It is not the sort of more racially and economically diverse and inclusive notion of the people that I would argue would be sort of a central part of a truly small d democratic response to the problem of economic power, right? So I think we're seeing sort of a threat to the idea, the thick idea of democracy that I'm articulating, both in terms of its exclusionary notion and in terms of its sort of deregulatory notion. That I think, you know, sort of on a bunch of normative grounds, right, we ought to not promote, not desire.
Yeah, the very interesting book published by Oxford University Press in 2016 is Democracy Against Domination. Spiel, thank you so much for your time today.
Right, thank you, Heath.